The Public Safety Finance Division will come to order. Members, we have a few things on our agenda today. Just review them real quickly. Today will be the last budget that we'll hear, at least for now, until we get our target, which is the Board of Judicial Standards. Then we have several bills, Representative Dabney's bill, Representative Portman's bill, Representative Hillstrom's bill. I have told Representative Thiessen that he did not need to be here. I'm not sure if he'll come. This bill actually should have gone to the Transportation Finance Committee. As you know, we have sort of that split arrangement with the with public safety being partially in this division and partially in transportation. So if he doesn't show, we will simply refer that, have the bill recalled and sent to finance, transportation finance. So with that, we do have a quorum. I would entertain a motion to approve the minutes of March 10th, 2009. Representative Bigham moves the minutes of March 10th, 2009. Are there any questions? All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? That motion prevails. Then we will hear from David Paul, who's the Executive Director of the Board of Judicial Standards, and this is on page, towards the end of your budget book. There's relatively small, but if you want to follow along. Mr. Paul, welcome to the committee. If you'd like to just give a brief overview or, of the board and anything you want to tell us about your budget, that would be helpful.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. As a matter of just very brief review, we are the agency in state government that processes complaints alleging that judges and judicial officers have acted improperly from a standpoint of personal conduct. Of course, we have no power over any issue that relates to the merits of any case, whether a person should win or lose a case, as you are all aware. That is one major part of our function, and the second major part, is the educational function. We exist to advise judges and advise members of the public as to the rules of ethics, the procedures that we use, and very often the alternatives, especially with the public, the alternatives that they may employ to achieve their goals. In this biennium, the governor has proposed no change to our budget. You may recall that our budget was raised last year, last biennium. For the first time in something like 10 years, we were very, very close to not having enough funds to function at that time, and the governor recommended at that point that our budget be increased, and this committee and the Senate agreed, and it was ultimately adopted. This increased budget has been a great success. There's just no other way to describe it. We were so underfunded before, and now we are well funded given our level of our staff, which is me and my assistant. The main benefit of the extra funding has been the revolving fund, which is $125,000 per year. And this fund has allowed us to engage attorneys more easily, investigators more easily, allowing our board to act on the best type of information and the best type of advice. And, of course, because we can hire investigators and health service providers directly now, we can save money on it, and we have saved money on it throughout the year. You may recall that prior to the institution of the revolving fund, our only alternative was to engage an attorney and have the attorney advance those funds, which was, of course, at a much greater rate than we would pay if we had engaged directly. And then, of course, the attorney could wait for the funds until we could get before the committee or the interim committees to grant us the additional funds necessary. That's all by the wayside now. We are able to function so much better and save so much money through the institution of this fund. Of course, my hope and my recommendation is that this be continued through the next biennium. If there's any questions, I'd be certainly glad to take them at this time.
Are there any questions? Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Paul, I've got a few questions here I want to run by you. Number one is, approximately how many cases come before the Board of Judicial Standards in a year?
Mr. Paul.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Stevenson, the total number of contacts, that is, written complaints, phone calls, letters that do not constitute written complaints, is about 1,600 per year, a little less this year, maybe 1,580, something like that. The total number of written complaints that are brought before the board for their disposition is usually around 120 per year. In this case, last year it was a little over that.
Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And of those 120 cases that were forwarded to your department there, how many of those were responded to the persons that filed the grievance?
Mr. Paul.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure if I understand responded to...
Well, Representative Stevenson. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess what I'm trying to get to is if there is a complaint that's filed against a particular judge and that is put into writing, that person that filed the grievance, is there an action on the Judicial Board of Standards process to get back to that individual to tell them what the determination was of the board?
Yes, every letter we get, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, every letter we get is responded to by either me or by the, by me, and either by the board or me separately telling them that their allegation is not within our authority. In other words, it's more of a goes to the merits of the case as opposed to the personal conduct, and usually tries to direct them somewhere where they can meet their goal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the allegations, about what percentage of that 120 have merit and are pursued?
Mr. Paul.
Mr. Chairman, we have our annual report coming out today, and the annual report is going to be better than my memory, but I think that we had about maybe 10% were pursued to more than just investigating. You mean?
Mr. Chair, yes. Mr. Paul, to an investigation.
Oh, yeah. Okay, that's more than that. Probably around, maybe around 40. 40 of those cases were pursued by the board past the evaluation stage.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Paul, and of those 40 cases that were pursued, does the individual that filed the complaint ever receive a report back on the actions that were taken against or actions that were taken on behalf of the judge that the allegations were?
Mr. Paul.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Stevenson, yes, the individual who files the complaint always gets a letter from me stating that the board did administer some discipline or decided not to, and usually gives a short rendition of why that's called for in the rules.
Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Paul, I'll be interested to, you said that report is coming out today, and I'll be very interested to take a look at that and maybe have some further discussion in the future.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Paul?
Yeah, it will come out today, and I don't think you're on the list specifically, although the law library will get it. But if you want, I can send it to you and any member of the committee. I'd be more than happy to send it.
Why don't you send it to the whole committee? Because I said it to Ms. McMahon, and she'll get it. That'd be the easiest way to do it. Representative Smith?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Mr. Paul, how long have you had your position as head of the Board of Judicial Standards?
Mr. Paul?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, it's been, I think, my 11th year is coming up here.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Mr. Paul, during that time, you've just recounted on a last year's basis 1,600 incoming complaints, 120 written. During your 11 years, you've had an occasion to review hundreds of complaints against judges. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman. We have a running total of that for the 10-year period. I think it's right around 13,000 for the period.
Mr. Can you hold on one second?
Yes.
If members of the audience have their cell phones on, please turn them off. They interrupt the sound system here. I'm sorry, Representative Smith, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Just maybe a question or two more. Mr. Paul, since you've reviewed that many and you've done this for 11 years, Are you able to form an opinion as to the quality of the men and women who make up our judiciary in this state?
Mr. Chairman?
Indeed,
we do have such an opinion.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Smith?
Mr. Paul, what is your opinion of our judges?
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Paul?
Representative Smith, my view of the judges is based not only on the conduct of the judges here in this state, but of course, I'm in intimate contact with other states and have, you know, weekly reviews from the types of activities that other states are engaged in with respect to their judges. There are some really, really serious cases across this country of judges who are not acting properly. As a rule, those cases do not occur here. We had an unfortunate case which was publicized this morning. That is the first case that the second case this year that we've had publicized. It is really quite a rare thing for that serious a discipline to be necessary in our state, because the quality of the judiciary is really so high, in my view. And so it's there's a lot of kind of private discipline, kind of private conversations, a lot of interaction with judges as to what the right thing to do is, a lot of things that are not, don't require discipline, but just require communication. And we do a lot of that. And of course, the public doesn't hear about that. But in terms of real serious cases, we have very little compared to other states.
Mr. Chairman,
final question. Mr. Paul, I think just about every question asked can be answered in one of three ways, yes, no, or I don't know. So after hearing your testimony and your comments just now, would it be safe to say that in the courts in the state of Minnesota, law is being applied fairly and that our citizens are receiving justice?
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
Yes, no, or...
Yeah, you know, the problem with that question is that it's phrased in a way which is kind of askew toward our authority. I mean, if you said, are the judges acting properly, generally speaking, apart from whether or not the law is being applied properly, our board can't possibly determine whether the law is being applied properly, but our board certainly can determine whether or not judges are in the process of finding facts and applying laws are acting properly, and my answer to that would be a resounding yes.
Mr. Chairman,
I use the word fairly, not properly, but I don't want to get into semantics. It sounds like we have an excellent judiciary.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Paul.
Yeah, I would agree with you, Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Stevenson.
Mr. Chair, and I appreciate that line of questioning. I guess my concerns are, and hopefully, Mr. Chair, it'll come up that we'll have an opportunity to hear about that. On a general rule, I think we probably do have an outstanding judiciary. The question is, how does the system handle those who are not? A small percentage of individuals who are abusing their authority from the bench could create devastating effects on individual lives. Those are the things I think that are on the purview of this committee, and those are things that I think are worthy of discussion. When you have terms of general, it's like saying on the last election that there's a margin of error that's acceptable, and when you have 2.3 million votes cast and you've got a 255 vote difference, margins of error aren't acceptable. And the same thing on the judiciary from a bench. If there's an individual who has a case who feels like they've been abused from the bench, they should have some recourse. And what I'm hearing from you, Mr. Paul, is that there is no recourse through the Judicial Board of Standards in terms of what they're, how the judge is applying that law, merely on their conduct. And those are questions that I think need to come before this committee, and my hope so we could have a good discussion on what some of those remedies might be.
Mr. Chairman, may I comment?
Good problem.
Yeah, well, Peterson, you make a good point, but it is really an essential point. And the point is, I think, and I've been doing this for a long time now, the point is, I think that if our board, the powers of our board were, say, expanded into an area of perhaps how a judge finds facts or applies the law, if our board were expanded into that area, I think that we would have problems with the judicial branch, because under our Constitution, the judicial branch is the exclusive power to determine facts in a court case and to apply the law. And of course, the remedy, if those facts are incorrectly found or if that law is incorrectly applied, is appeal. And of course, I don't pretend to say that the judges in the state constantly apply the law correctly, because that would put our appeals courts out of business. And you can just see that there's a lot of discussion and a lot of activity regarding how the law is applied and how facts are found. But that is traditionally the reason for the existence of the appellate system, and it would be difficult for us. I mean, we don't have a trial system, we don't have a courtroom, we have none of the advantages that the judiciary has and the court system has to make these determinations. What we can do, however, is make sure that whatever determination is made, whatever fact is found, whatever law is applied, is done in a way that is respectful to court participants and is courteous and is impartial and carries with it the independence of the judiciary.
One more question or statement, Mr. Chair, and I think it goes to the core of the issue here, is that if you, in a hypothetical case, I'm saying that just for this discussion, in a hypothetical case where you have a judge who is consistently ruling from the bench, either by rule and overstepping his bounds in terms of supporting or defending the statute overruling, and that happens on a consistent basis, and you're saying that the Board of Judicial Standards merely has oversight over the conduct. If there are rulings that are going beyond the purview of his authority from the bench, then what I'm hearing is there's no recourse within the system for that judge to be disciplined to ensure that those decisions that he's making that are beyond his perspective, whether he's legislating from the bench or whether there's disregard, there's no recourse in the system for the individuals who are hurt by that decision to come back and have some redress.
Mr. Paul, briefly, then we're going to move on.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. This is, you are generally correct. However, if there is a personal element, in other words, if a judge is consistently denying attorneys to criminal defendants, if a judge is consistently ignoring the law of custody, for example, and you can determine that if there is some personal element, some bias, some prejudice, some resentment from a prior case, that is something that the board can act on. Those are more difficult cases, but the board can and has acted on those things, as has other states. So the key here, Representative Stevenson, is determining whether or not there's a personal element. A judicial mistake is a judicial mistake. But if there's a personal element, something not, which is not judicial, but is, comes from the individual itself, the board can look at that, and always has been able to.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Paul, for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Okay, we're going to hear, I believe it's in Dabneysville, is first House File 554. I need to move this. I'm going to move House File 554, and we'll be laying this bill over. We, as the chair of the Capital Investment Committee, we will be sending a memo to the committee about relative to the bonding requests that have come to our committee. And Representative Dabney, I believe yours is the only one what is actually a hearing request. So you might be our only memo.
I could accept that, Mr. Chair.
Representative Dabney, welcome to the committee. You want to please explain your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Good morning. And thank you for the opportunity to, again, present the Regional Training, Fire Training and Emergency Operations Center proposal to you. With me today is Rocco Forte, the Director of Emergency Management for the City of Minneapolis, and Betsy Hodges, Minneapolis City Council member. Before turning things over to Mr. Forte, I'd just like to take a moment to talk a little bit about this multi-use, multi-jurisdictional project that, if funded, will serve three purposes. Number one, provide a much-needed and much larger emergency operations center available to the region. Some of the lessons of 9/11 were locate your emergency operations center outside of the urban core, but accessible to the region. This Fridley location serves both of those goals. It provides a home for state-sponsored emergency response equipment and mobilization point for participating agencies for whatever sort of disaster or emergency may occur, and serves regularly as important needed classroom and support space for an already existing fire training campus, which serves over 30 different jurisdictions, including the Minnesota National Guard, as well as police and sheriff training. I would like to add some really good news, that since coming to you last year, an additional federal grant has been secured, and so the request now for state assistance to support the state assets that are there has dropped from an $8 million request to a $3 million request. That alone should be a reason, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, at this point, I'd like to hand it over to Mr. Forte from the Emergency Management Department of the City of Minneapolis.
Very good. Mr. Forte, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, committee members, I am the Director of Emergency Preparedness for the City of Minneapolis. I have been for about 5 years. For the 30 years prior to that, I was on the Minneapolis Fire Department and retired as fire chief. During that period of time, in approximately 1993, the City of Minneapolis bought 9.3 acres in Fridley to start a regional fire training facility. At that time, we invested over $6 million into our fire training tower itself, a burn building, a hazmat pad where all of our local firefighters could train in hazmat, confined space, and just in 2004, we invested in a collapsed structure training site also. The only piece that is missing is our emergency operations center that would also have a strategic information center now that we have that technology, along with classroom for the fire training of that. And as we've gone through this process, the building is approximately $14 million. We're putting approximately $6 million in from the City of Minneapolis and have acquired about $5 million in grants from the Urban Area Security Initiative, along with the Coast Guard, who are willing to put about $2 million into the facility so they can have a camera system along the Mississippi and have a strategic information center where they can view those cameras at all times and work out of our facility. We also have letter of agreements with Hennepin County, Ramsey County, Dakota, Anoka, Washington, Chisago, Isani, Carver, and Scott County that they would use that facility if there was a large event. But we've worked out as a process where in the smaller EOCs, in those counties, as well as Minneapolis and St. Paul, we have video conferencing for all the EOC, for all the emergency operations centers. But this facility is large enough to hold about approximately 120 people that we would need for command, for logistics, for planning, for operations, and finance during a large event. I'd also like to point out that when we had the bridge collapse, it was considered one of the most successful managed emergencies in the country. But when they did the after-action report from the federal government, they identified the fact that we had too small of an EOC as the main hindrance of that incident. We only had about 20 people in our emergency operations center, and they recommended about 120. We went through best practices to identify the best possible facility that we could build within this finance system that we have. We had $14 million. Chicago's is about $600 million, so obviously we're falling short of that. But we have also utilized technology where we've already been able to acquire, access about 750 cameras between MnDOT and Minneapolis and St. Paul. And we can grow that out to all the counties, and we can also grow that out with the National Guard. With that, I would be glad to answer any questions that may arise.
Ms. Hodges, did you want to? Oh, did you have a question?
Representative Smith?
Mr. Chairman, I do. towards the end of your testimony, you identified the federal report, identified you had 20 folks instead of 120, and that as that reason that you were, quote, the main hindrance of that incident. Two-part question. What do you mean you were hindering that incident? What does that mean? And number two, what were some other hindrances if you were the main one?
Mr. Forte.
Through the chair, the main hindrance, according to the After Action Report, was the fact that we couldn't have our logistics, our planning, and our operations all together. We had to piecemeal them in different parts of the city of Minneapolis because we didn't have a large enough facility at that time to do the work that we, quite frankly, that had to be done. Although we got it done, it was a hindrance that we were not all together and had as clear communications as we possibly could have. In the report itself, it has 11 lessons learned, which are basically things that we could do better on, and 18 best practices that other people from out the country can learn from that. The main one, from my perspective, was the fact that we had a smaller EOC. Some of the other issues were firefighters too close to the river with turnout gear on and smaller issues like that. The largest issue, quite frankly, that can be dealt with brick and mortar and technology is the size of the emergency operations center.
Mr. Chairman, that's all for now.
Mr. Haas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Representative Testifiers, isn't there another fire training facility like 5 miles away from this proposed one, and why wouldn't that be conflicting, or is the mission different? To explain to me why that would be good use of money to build one that close.
Sure. Mr. Forte.
Through the chair, committee members, quite frankly, there's approximately 834 fire departments in the state of Minnesota, so there is all types of different training facilities all throughout our state. This specifically is an emergency operations center, and I went through the list of counties that we've dealt with to do that. The other fire training facilities will have some of the props that I talked about earlier, but they do not have an emergency operations center or a strategic information center that are involved with them.
Representative Haas.
So that you think then that the missions are different? Different enough that this is a wise use of money, is that what you're saying?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Representative Cole.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First to Representative Dabney, in light of your introductory statements and the memo we have from the City of Minneapolis describing the request, would you be supportive, Representative Dabney, of an amendment on line 1.7 and 1.14 to reduce $8 million to $3 million?
I've got all of my notes and no copies of the bill. One moment. It's not a problem. Yes, 1.7 and 1.14. That would be fine, Mr. Chair.
Representative Chair, I would make that amendment.
I'm sorry. Go ahead,
Mr. Chair. I move that amendment.
Please do it again. I was distracted here.
Not a problem. On line 1.7,
okay.
Strike $8 million. Insert $3 million. On line 1.14, strike $8 million. Insert $3 million.
Okay. Does everyone understand the amendment? Mm-hmm. And you were supportive of that?
That is our need.
Okay. Is there any discussion? All those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That motion prevails. Representative Cole.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dabney, you've got me in a tough spot here. Mr. Forte, I like this project. I like this proposal. I'm not yet convinced that the state of Minnesota should go forward with bonding this year. That said, I also fully recognize that I don't run the show here, and we very well may be passing a bonding bill. If that's the case, and if this is all that the Public Safety Committee is going to be moving forward, I am supportive of this proposal. I'm not sure that given our massive budget problems that we have, that we really should be doing a bonding bill, pulling out the credit card once again. I understand from a public safety perspective why we would want to do this. I guess it's a question of the relative need versus the relative want, and also our ability to afford to pull out the credit card once again. I appreciate the fact that this project has been reduced almost by two-thirds, You know, if we're going to do a bonding bill, even if I don't support that broader decision, this is a project that I hope finds its way in. So I support the project. I support what you're trying to do. I just question whether whether we should be pulling out the state's credit card again this year. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Other questions? Representative Dabney, Oliver Haas raised the issue. I've also privately expressed some concerns I had about the close proximity to this other facility. And Mr. Forte, I understand there's other services that you will be providing relative to training at your Minneapolis site that I think we do need to, when it gets to capital investment, we will be submitting the report on training centers as well as the on labs that have been created over the last 10 years so that the Capital Investment Committee can see, because it meets some of the criteria, but this close proximity I think is problematic, and that was why we had the statewide task force to ensure that some of these centers weren't were geographically placed in the proper places. So just want you to know that is going to Chair Houseman, those documents, and you'll probably have to make your case to that committee.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate your having raised the issue, the question with me privately, and to thank Representative Haas for raising it publicly, because a good vetting is what the public deserves. We're still investigating, and I think hopefully we'll be able to demonstrate that there's not a duplication, but complementary nature, or is it simply that the Northwest Fire Training Center meets some needs but does not meet the full range of needs that the Emergency Operations Center that we're proposing here does, and that there's space for both and a need, frankly, for both.
Very good. Any other questions? Ms. Hodges, did you want to say anything or no?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Indeed, and I think it speaks to this issue. Last year when I was speaking...
Introduce yourself.
I'm sorry. I'm Betsy Hodges. I'm on the Minneapolis City Council and chair of the city's Intergovernmental Relations Committee, and appreciate the chance to talk about this today. And last year when we were talking about this project, I think I referred to it as a sweeper. With reasonable state investment, we can leverage our federal and local dollars, not only to have a fire training center, not only to have an emergency center, but also to be a house for many state assets that the city of Minneapolis is responsible for taking care of. And this project would do all three of those things. This year it's also a fourfer, if you will, in that it's shovel ready, and that with state investment we could begin construction this spring. So thank you all for your time.
Very good. Ms. Rogers, thank you for your testimony. Mr. Forte, thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to address the committee on this bill, either for or against? Seeing none, Ms. Dandy, thank you. And the chair will lay over House File 554 and a memo that will be sent to the Capital Investment Committee regarding the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
Okay, next is Representative Portman. Representative Portman, welcome to the committee. I understand you have an author's amendment. The chair will move House File 267 and to be recommended to pass and return to the Finance Committee. And the chair will move the A4 amendment to get the bill in the order that the author desires. Is there any questions on the A4 amendment? All those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That motion prevails. Now the amended bill. Representative Cole.
Mr. Chair, I just have a question about the motion to send this to the Finance Committee. Can you explain why this isn't being laid over for inclusion in your bill? I'm not necessarily objecting. I'm just trying to understand.
Mr. Carter, can you shed some light on the fiscal note? I think this is one of these bills that this is the second one that we've had, the Burford Chiefman's bill, that, you know, we've sort of been in error in part because we have joint jurisdiction with transportation,
and the public and public safety, and so I think this may need. No, does it go to the transportation finance? Oh, okay. There's no more. Okay. So, as I understand it, there will not there from Ms. McMahon. There's no cost to the state. So there. To our committee, and I believe that's why it's going to finance and then to the floor. I believe.
Mr. Chair, I understand that sometimes things are decided that there's somebody other than you maybe decides that something will move on its own, and I'm not going to object at this time. I just find it odd. I realize there's no that the fiscal note is revenue neutral, but or expenditure and revenue neutral, but nonetheless there are some interactions with the state funds, and we would typically, I think, keep this bill here in this committee and put it in your bill, but I'll stop, Mr. Chair.
The only issue relative to our committee is that the money, it passes through the Supreme Court, which we have jurisdiction over. Representative Portman, we don't want to get into too much of the policy of the bill. I think this has been heard in several committees before. So if you could just briefly explain the bill, and then we'll just...
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, and we'll keep within our 15-minute allocation. I'll go over the fiscal note in a little bit of detail, but what I'd like to do is just have Gail Weinholzer from AAA explain the bill. She's got about 4 minutes, and then our police officer has about 4 minutes, and then we'll talk about the fiscal note.
Weinholzer, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Gail Weinholzer. I'm the Director of Public Affairs for AAA Minnesota, Iowa. I'm here representing our 700,000 members that have consistently supported this legislation by more than 80% in our member surveys on an annual basis. We knew a large, broad-based coalition in support of this legislation, and I'd like, in public policy, we discussed a great deal of the issues surrounding this bill. I'd like to bring forward a demo to give you a better understanding of what we're talking about, because there was a bit of confusion in the past committee. Coming forward is 6-year-old Abby Swanson. Abby is our star testifier. She's done this for quite a few committees, but her mother, Shannon, is a member of my staff. Abby is, as I mentioned, 6 years old, and she's going to demonstrate why a booster seat is important to children. As you can see in this demo chair, Abby is significantly smaller than the adult she felt should be fitting her properly. When we talk about adult seatbelts, they are just that. They're designed to restrain adults. If you notice with a smaller child, because a car seat is large, it's very uncomfortable for them to wear an adult seatbelt. They typically, on longer drives, will slouch down so that the knees bend at the end of the seat, because that's what makes it comfortable for them. Well, what happens is the adult seatbelt slides up on her tummy, which can cause internal injuries because it's not riding on her hips where the bone structure can absorb the crash. And then it also rides up a bit on her throat and face area, which of course is very uncomfortable. If she were to leave that seatbelt across her throat, it would cause her to have neck injuries. And if she, because of comfort, moves it behind her back like many children do, in the event of a crash when her body, because of the crash forces, bends forward, it will inevitably sever her spine. Now Abby will get out of the chair and show what a backless booster does to enhance her safety. When we talk about a backless booster, Shannon's bringing an example forward. This is about a $13 to $15 purchase at Walmart or Target. And what it does is it literally boosts the child up so that the adult seatbelt fits properly. The adult seatbelt will now fit over her hips and her shoulder, so it'll be over the bone structure of the body and therefore not over the fleshy part of the body, the muscles, the intestines, and those areas, and therefore protect the child much better than an adult seatbelt does on its own. 44 other states have passed legislation that protect our children better than the state of Minnesota does, including most of our Midwestern states. So I would encourage you, on behalf of our members and on behalf of our youngest passengers, to pass this legislation and move it forward so that we can protect them and make our roadways safer. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else that...
Officer, I'm sorry, I don't remember your name. O'Neill.
Good afternoon, the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Officer Kevin O'Neill. I'm a police officer with the City of Lakeville Police Department. I've had an opportunity to come and speak with some of you before on this, and thank you again for your time today. I've been a police officer for 16 years, and over the years, many of my duties have revolved around specialized assignments in traffic safety and community programs, including the Child Passenger Safety Program. I'm also the father of four small children, and as such, I've had a lot of practical experience with child safety seats like this. Professionally, I do spend a considerable amount of time educating and helping members of our community with things like car safety seat checkups, child safety seat clinics. I also have an opportunity to speak with parent groups, daycares, and schools on the topic of child passenger safety. Through these contacts, I've learned that there is a lot of confusion out there regarding what's best and what's safest when it comes to buckling up your children. And that sometimes the state statute that many people refer to as their guidance is confusing and somewhat incomplete. When I have the opportunity to explain what the best practices is regarding booster seats to parents, many times they simply just ask me, well, what does the law say? And since our present law does not address booster seats, I frequently respond to them with comments about the laws of physics in some of the ways they just explained to you here and how the seatbelt can actually hurt you, and try and make an emphasis on that being more important than any law that might earn you a traffic citation. Updating Minnesota's law is not a means for us to issue more citations as law enforcement officers, but rather updating the law would be an opportunity to make more parents and caregivers aware of the proper and safest way to restrain children in a motor vehicle. As with almost every traffic law, law enforcement officers also have discretion in most enforcement situations, and this bill is not an attempt to criminalize parents. It's simply a means to make children safer in cars when parents may not understand the dynamics of a crash. When you consider this bill, please remember that the present law already requires children in this age group to be buckled up, and the proposed change to the law only updates the law and specifies that we buckle up kids in the safest way by using the type of seats that are now commonly and inexpensively available in the marketplace. In addition, any enforcement of this proposed enhancement to the child restraint law would be handled just as the present law is. Our present state statute also has specific age requirements, but those have always been handled by officers with a common sense approach and by simply asking parents for any specific information they may need, such as the child's height, the age, the weight. Parents don't need to worry about having birth certificates or proving age or carrying tape measures with them to show the height. In the event that a driver may actually be issued a citation for this offense, we still have an option that's already part of the existing child restraint statute. That option is for the person to have their ticket completely dismissed if they were to obtain a proper safety or booster seat within 14 days of the ticket being issued. The driver can simply bring proof of purchase for the seat and a copy of their ticket to the police station. The ticket is dismissed. There's no fine or no record of the citation on their driving license record. It's handled like any other fixer ticket that people may be familiar with for things like a cracked windshield or burnt out headlight on your car. Education and awareness are just as important as enforcement when it comes to the goal of traffic safety, and a clear and appropriate state statute can help accomplish both of those goals. Recently, in a traffic crash that I had investigated in Lakeville, I had a situation where an injured child was injured due to the misuse of a child safety seat. It contributed significantly to the child's injuries. And during the investigation, as I mentioned before, the confusion about parents and understanding what is safest to do. The mother of the injured child commented repeatedly to me that she was unsure and confused about what was the best or safest way to buckle up her child. By passing this bill, much of that same confusion experienced by this lady and other Minnesota parents can be eliminated. Everyone knows that seatbelts save lives, but a seatbelt that doesn't fit properly will not protect the child in a crash. And absolutely, booster seats solve this problem. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Officer O'Neill, thank you for your testimony. Mr. Harmon.
The reason why we had the demo even before you today is just to show the bone structure issue. The reason why I picked up this bill after Representative Duke Powell was no longer the chief author is because I didn't know as a mom, you know, when my kids were supposed to be in a booster seat and not until AAA came to ask me to co-author the booster seat bill in 2005. And my kids were 8 and 10 at the time, and we had just spent about the last 3 years arguing about whether they needed to be in booster seats or not and not really knowing what the right standard was. And I think that the officer puts it into perspective. This is merely an update of our statute. We put the booster seat requirement into effect when technology was different and our understanding of the bone structure and everything was different, and these type of booster seats were not commonly available. So this is an update rather than a fundamental change. But I want to walk through the fiscal note because I know that's what you're most interested in and why we're here. We had quite a lot of conversation among the fiscal staff and myself about whether we were supposed to be coming to this committee or not. And let me just tell you what the fiscal note did and then what the amendment took care of. Right now, if you're driving around and any of us get pulled over, we have a six-year-old in the back seat and she is not buckled up. She's bouncing around. A police officer sees she's obviously not buckled up and pulls you over. You will get a $25 ticket under the current seatbelt for kids law, which is 169.686. You would get a ticket for $25. Of that $25 ticket, 90% goes to the emergency medical
services relief
account. 10% goes to the Office of Traffic Safety. The way this bill was originally drafted, if my bill were passed, and that's the new law, and you're driving around, you have a six-year-old in your back seat, she's bouncing around, and the officer pulls you over and sees she's clearly not restrained, you would get a ticket under the booster seat bill, which is 169.685. There's a $50 fine, and the presumption was that entire $50 would go into the child passenger restraint account. What I did with the A4 amendment was just hold the emergency services relief account harmless and said, for that first $25, let's just distribute it the way we always have. We'll have that first $4,000 go into the emergency medical relief services fund. So this makes it a zero fiscal impact. It doesn't change things for the emergency medical relief fund. And we're just now looking at an increase in revenue from the second $25 that goes into the child passenger restraint account. And 80% of that money is used directly to parents to buy booster seats. 20% of the money is given to nonprofits who distribute car seats to the poor.
I think that clarifies things. Member DeLash.
Thank you. Question is for Ms. Weinholzer. Ms. Weinholzer, how many children, or statistics, do you have national statistics or Minnesota statistics, how many children's spinal cords have been severed by them being in regular restraints?
Ms. Weinholzer.
As far as the specific crash situation, the severed spine, when we do crash facts, and I'm referring to the 2008 Department of Public Safety crash facts, they divide things as serious injury, minor injury, and uninjured. So it's difficult to say exactly how many within a specific state have a specific injury. And I would draw your attention to the last page in the packet that was provided. And this is current data from, as I mentioned, the 2008 crash facts. The story that that we've been sharing with folks is the story of Bryn Duncan. And she was one of the children that had suffered a severe spinal cord injury this past August. And we've been sharing her story with you, but as far as specific types of injuries, it's difficult to determine. But if you notice with the 2008 crash facts sheet that's at the last page in your packet, it shows not only the limited use of booster seats, regrettably, in the state of Minnesota, but the significant impact of their, on their safety. The data shows two things. First, that only about 15% of parents are currently using a booster in this age group. And I would contend, based on the phone calls that we get from parents, that is largely due to state statute. And that those children that did use a booster seat were, for the most part, harmless left harmless in the event of a crash. 84% were completely uninjured, and only 13% suffered minor injuries. No child using a booster seat died in a car crash in the state of Minnesota.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Lack, Ms. Weinholzer, and my question was related to your testimony that regarding spinal cord severing, because you stated that, that's inevitable if there's a crash and that a booster seat is not used. Is that your testimony? Because that's what I heard.
I'm sorry. If I said it was inevitable, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative Lack. That said, it was inevitable. That was an improper phrase. What I should have said is that when a child puts the seatbelt upper portion behind their back, as they typically do when it rubs across their face or the neck, it highly increases their chance of having a severed spinal cord, because in the impact of a crash, and of course it would depend on the crash impact, if you hit someone going 5 miles an hour versus 30 miles an hour, there's going to be a significant difference. But without the upper portion of the body restrained, the body will snap in half, and that typically will lead to a severed spinal cord. If you also notice the statistics from the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, in a significant research study that they did earlier this decade, it shows that a child using a booster seat is 59% less likely to be injured and 28% less likely to die.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. They were short answer questions. That was my intent anyway, Mr. Chair. But by way of comment, despite what I think some of the testimony may be by Officer O'Neill and others, we are criminalizing behavior here, members. I have some concerns with this. A lot of smart people get together and decide that these are best practices, and somehow because they decide the numbers show it could make kids safer, that everyone else should too, and we're going to criminalize the rest of behavior. I think that it probably is a smart move for parents to use these. No question about it. I used one for my child, and there was some argument in my household too about when that ended, but it was up to about age 7, I think, when I started putting her in the back seat with just the lap belt, and probably till about 8, till my ex-wife did it. Nonetheless, what we're deciding is that if you don't take the prevailing opinion, that we're going to make this criminal. And there's argument that no, you can just take it in and fix it. But I have concerns about that, and I'm going to be voting no on this. But Representative Hortman, you knew that already, so thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Chair, I hope we send a note to our young testifier's teachers. He's now had more civic credit here for several committees than 99.9% of Minnesotans. But my question for Representative Hortman, Mr. Chair, or Ms. Weinholzer is, what do we do if we've got families that literally can't afford to pick one of these up?
Ms. Weinholzer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Weiner, there's a significant number of organizations that assist with the purchase of child seats and booster seats for low-income families. AAA Minnesota Iowa provides large grants across the state of Minnesota to groups like the Dakota County Safe Communities, the Masabi Safe Communities, and those types of organizations that see car seats. And if the family comes in and says, you know, I don't have the funds for a car seat or a booster seat, we provide that free of charge. The Safe Communities, sincere representing Safe Communities and the Minnesota Safety Council, they do the same thing. The Department of Public Safety uses some of the fines money that has been allocated to their account to do the same thing. County health officials have many times the same resources. There are many resources available for low-income families, and I would also draw your attention back to the current statute that we have requiring the car seat. That's actually the expensive purchase for a parent. I mean, car seat, when we're talking about the folks that are under age 4, that can be $50 to $75. When we're talking about a backlift booster, that's $13 to $15 at Walmart or Target. But for those that do not have the funds available, there are plenty of sources available.
Please follow up, Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Officer O'Neill, I know most officers try to be educators versus the heavy. Is that information you generally have available that you can share with someone when you have to talk to them about this? You can point them in the right direction for help.
Officer O'Neill.
Mr. Chair, Representative. Yes, sir. Information on the statute is something that we have readily available to us. There's things such as even a reference card that police officers carry in their vehicles that give you, if you're not the most intimately familiar with it as a patrolman, give you the guidelines again so that you can properly explain things to people. And then many police departments, like my own, have somebody like myself who has some credentials in child passenger safety, where that's part of my job as I do go out and do some outreach and education, maybe above and beyond what the average patrolman would do.
Mr. Chair, Officer O'Neill, that,
right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you'd be able to point them to help if they need help in getting one of these. And I mean, I'm concerned about the financial side of it.
Mr. Representative. Yes, sir. As a matter of fact, we have some of those seats that they were talking about available through these programs. We have them at our police department. So in addition to the education, if need be, I can simply walk to the back room and give them a seat right then and there.
Representative Olin,
is this
on this point, and then I'll go to Representative
Liebling. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's directly on this point. And the question I have is, under the statute, as I read it, they have 14 days to get one. So if you got the situation where you had a poor person, couldn't afford one themselves, if somebody could help them within those 14 days get one, is this correct?
Ms. Weinholzer.
Sure, for my Representative Olin, absolutely.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and just quickly, I wasn't going to say anything except after Representative Lesh spoke. I think I have to. First of all, I mean, I am a big supporter of this bill. I think it's great, and thank you, Representative Horton, for carrying it again this year and for being such a great advocate for this. I want to say a couple things. I mean, there's a big libertarian streak that we have here at the legislature sometimes, and I think we have to remember, first of all, that when it comes to children and protecting kids, this is a very proper function of government. Sometimes I get emails saying, you know, we shouldn't interfere, parental rights and all that. You know, and that's true, but I think that when it comes to kids, that we do lots of things to protect our kids. And I know they're very legitimate things. We don't let our kids work in coal mines, you know? We don't. Even if the parents want them to, and even if they need the money, we don't let them do it. So I think this is very appropriate. Secondly, your rights may stop when it affects me, you know, and so things that people want to do that affect their own safety and nobody else, you know, maybe that we should let them do that. But in this case, even if we get away from the kid argument, we have the fact that when a child is injured, severely injured, that's going to affect our state budget most likely. And I'm on Health and Human Services, and we see, and those who are know, that a lot of our costs are driven by people with severe disabilities who then, in fact, become the state's responsibility for the rest of their lives. And that is an enormous fiscal impact that's growing and growing. And anything that we can do, not simply on the level of, I mean, certainly for the children themselves, this is so important, but from the point of view of the state budget, it's also extremely important. And I also want to commend our young actress there. This is the first time I got a chance to see the demonstration, and it's just so helpful and wonderful. And thank you for bringing her down, and thank you to her for doing it. And that's all I want to say.
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Mr. Chairman, I have a question of Ms. Weinholzer, and I know this may sound picky, but I'm having a little trouble gleaning answers to the questions I'm hearing from your long answer. But there was a question in or more on the specifics of a parent not being able to afford a seat. Your testimony to the question is, what happens if somebody comes to you and says, we can't afford one? Your answer was, if people come to us at AAA and say, we can't afford one, that you'll provide one free. So is it your testimony that if anybody in the state comes to AAA and says, I have a child under 8, etc., and I need a car seat, I can't afford one, that AAA will provide the free seats free?
Ms. Weinholzer.
Chair Paymar, Representative Smith, it is our intention that if we cannot, we will in every case attempt to provide one. If we cannot, we will help them make contact with an association that can. We have a lot of traffic safety partners that are all interested in this, and all provide car seats and booster seats across the state, the Minnesota Safety Council, Safe Kids, that sort of thing. So we are more than interested in, if we can't, we will hook them up with someone who can and make sure it gets done. It's not an issue that should inhibit anyone's vote. And in fact, I should even take things one step further. We don't wait for people to come to us. We do car seat clinics across the state, in many communities, throughout the calendar year. Anytime anyone comes to any of those car clinics, either with an out-of-date car seat or they can't afford one, we provide it to them. So it's not necessarily a case where they even have to come to us. We come to them. We do car seat clinics in Hibbing and across the metropolitan area. We've given money to communities. So that shouldn't be any inhibition to passing this legislation.
Mr. Chairman, so Ms. Weinholzer, if anybody comes to AAA and says, I want a car seat, AAA will either provide them one free, or you'll see that they get one free from somewhere else. Is that what you're saying?
Assuming they're low, assuming they're low-income family, absolutely.
Representative Smith.
Well, Mr. Chairman, what's your measurement on determining who gets one free and who
doesn't?
Mr. Chair,
in the social service community, I used to be a legal aid lawyer. There are federal poverty guidelines that require that qualify people for a range of services, whether it's county assistance and emergency assistance type fund or legal services. And the nonprofit community that assists low-income families generally all use the same scale and are generally in very close contact with each other. This is the kind of thing that I can easily see people going through their legal aid office and saying, I got this ticket, where do I go? And through United Way, legal aid office is helping. And the point I'm trying to make is that there is a guideline for what is a low-income family. It depends on how many children you have. It depends on where you fall in the federal poverty guidelines. And it's such a commonly used scale in the nonprofit community that I'm certain that's what would be referenced in providing a car seat for free.
Mr. Chairman, I need to nail this down. Ms. Weinholzer, your previous testimony was that if somebody comes to you and says they cannot afford a car seat, AAA would provide them one free. Your subsequent testimony was that you would attempt to see that they got one free. Now the testimony is that they would meet some kind of standard poverty level. What measurement, guidelines, or standard is AAA going to use to decide who gets a free car seat and who doesn't?
Ms. Weinholzer.
Chair Paymer, we've never turned anyone away, I guess is what I'm trying to communicate. Whether they've come to us or they've come to one of our car seat clinics across the state of Minnesota, we've never turned anyone away. In fact, oftentimes, if someone's using a car seat or a booster seat that's expired or been recalled, we replace it free of charge. They don't even know they need it replaced. I guess that's what I'm trying to communicate. We've never said no to anyone. We never intend to say no to anyone.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not going to waste any more of your time. Thank you.
Is there any other questions or comments? Representative Hilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually wasn't going to speak on this, but I got a personal email from Brent's family asking me why I voted against Brent. Members, I don't support this legislation. I've been a mother. I have had three children in the car, a two-door car, and frankly, with three booster seats, they don't fit. So I have consistently said that I would support this legislation up to the age of six, but having run kids to Little League and run groups of kids to swim practice, it is very, very difficult to get three children in the back seat of a car, and with airbags in the front, you can't put them in the front either. So that is why I'll be voting no.
Is there anybody in the audience who wishes to speak for or against this bill? Ms. McKelly, did you have a comment?
Yes, Mr. Chair, just a quick question. Are the manufacturers with the adjustable now shoulder belt, are they addressing this issue that way?
Mr. Weinholz.
Chair Paymer, Representative Kelly. They are attempting to address the issue. But it typically only helps shorter adults. It doesn't typically help children. As you noticed, Abby Swanson, 6 years old, an adjustable car seat still wouldn't be a significant impact for increasing her safety.
That's okay. I think we'll take up to Cornish and then vote unless anyone has a... Because we have one more bill, unless anyone has a burning issue. Representative Cornish.
Well, Mr. Chairman and members, I'm a grandparent of 8 grandchildren, and it might be difficult to do this, but life is difficult, and changing diapers and bottle feeding in the middle of the night is difficult, but we're grandparents and parents, and we do it. We take care of our children. I think this is a good idea for a little cost, and I'm going to vote for the bill.
Okay, anything else, Representative Hartman? Thank you all for your testimony. Then the chair will renew his motion that House File 267, as amended, be recommended to pass and return to the Finance Committee. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
No.
That motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Hartman.
Thank you.
The final bill today is Representative Hillstrom. And this,
Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee, this committee, Representative Hillstrom. You want to introduce the bill? You want to move your bill first?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I would move that House File 509 be laid over for possible inclusion. Mr. Chair, I believe that there is still some discussion about whether or not this has a fiscal impact or not. And so this was brought to me by the Board of Public Defense, and so it would be my understanding that if there isn't a fiscal note, I'd carry it in my bill, and if there is, you would consider whether or not to carry it in yours.
Go ahead. Do you want to introduce the bill?
Mr. Chair, I would actually like to turn it over to the Public Defense Board and let them talk about their bill and why they need it.
Carter, you want to introduce yourself for the record?
Mr. Chairman and members, for the record, my name is Kevin Carter. I'm the Chief Administrator with the Board of Public Defense. Most of you heard this bill in the Policy Committee, and it really deals with two issues, eligibility for public defender services and also reimbursement for public defender services. And I don't know, Mr. Chairman, if you want me to go through the entire bill or kind of address the two sections that deal with the financial or the potential financial impacts.
Why don't you at least explain what the bill does,
sure,
and then go through those two elements.
Mr. Chairman, Section 1 updates the statutes to reflect a Supreme Court decision of State v. Johnson, which allows for the defendant to have to give their consent to have a misdemeanor certified as a petty misdemeanor. At that point, also in Section 1, the defendant would not be eligible for a public defender, and we're clarifying that they would not be because there is no jail time that's associated with a petty offense. Section 2 would replace current language for who is eligible for a public defender or the determination of eligibility by putting in a dollar threshold. One of the things that we're trying to achieve here is to have a solid line where judges look at, but they're all looking at the same thing, and hopefully bring a little consistency to that determination across the state. Chairman, Section 3, we're attempting to amend Section 611.18, which is really some outdated language on the appointment of appellate defense and also the defense in conflict cases. Right now, it says in the statute that the state public defender would be assigned. In conflict cases, it's the local chief public defender who decides when there are conflicts and when there are not. In Section 4, we're dealing with public defender reimbursement. As we mentioned at the Policy Committee, the judges can order reimbursement for public defender services in throughout the state. That right now goes to part-time public defenders to offset their overhead. There's no impact on the general fund. We're basically the clearinghouse. It comes to us, we send it back out. Depending on how many folks in the district are part-time defenders. In Hennepin County, we do not have any state part-time defenders. What we're trying to do there is recognize that Hennepin County provides a significant contribution to that office and direct those reimbursements to the county. In Section 5, we are asking that the statute be changed from a shall to a may. In this instance, what we're trying to get at here is to have judges not feel compelled that they have to order reimbursement, and that there may be a mechanism that instead of ordering a public defender on a case, which then there's a mandatory reimbursement, to instead maybe take a second look at that or a look up front and say maybe that person should have private counsel or could afford private counsel rather than a public defender. And the repealer, Mr. Chairman, is a repealer of a section of the statute that has guidelines in it for reimbursement. And what we're proposing here is that the original or the application itself for the public defender is really the thing that the judge ought to go by. And frankly, our experience, or at least our chief public defender's experience, is that the judges have rarely, if ever, used this charge in the statute. So that is the bill. I think, Mr. Chairman, the two sections that folks had some questions on in terms of the financial side of this were Section 2, and I think we had a couple of questions in the policy committee of, is this going to impact in terms of the number of cases? We just don't know. I mean, what we're looking at, again, as I mentioned, is just to bring some consistency to this and give the judges something to look at so everybody's looking at the same thing and putting that dollar figure, or at least that percentage figure, in the statute. The other section, I think, that would jump out at folks would be Section 4, the reimbursements. And again, as I said, there's no impact there because the reimbursements right now don't go to the general fund. They're dispersed to part-time defenders, of which we don't have any in Hennepin. And so, again, we're trying to redirect those to recognize that the county does provide a significant portion of the budget in Hennepin County.
Mr. Perry, is the 4th Judicial District in Hennepin County, is that totally funded by that county? I mean, I know that, or does the state pay for part of their public defender services?
Mr. Chairman, the state is about two-thirds state, one-third county funding.
Okay, so then there wouldn't be any split then in Section 4 relative to that?
Mr. Chairman, no. Because again, as I mentioned, we don't have part-time state public defenders in that office.
This is just for part-time public defenders?
Right.
Okay. And you have no idea whether this is going to save the public defender office any money?
Mr. Chairman, no. At this point, what we're trying to do is to bring some consistency to it. And whether or not it does, you know, in some parts of the state maybe it does, maybe in some others it doesn't. We just, you know, I think what we've tried to do here is, and what we've heard from folks is, we want to at least put in some kind of thresholds here. And again, you can't have a hard and fast threshold. I think we found that out with the co-payment and mandatory co-payment several years ago, that was unconstitutional. Again, I think you'd run into the same issues with kind of a hard and fast determination on eligibility as well.
Final question from me anyway. In the fiscal note, it says the bill is likely to have a fiscal impact on the work of the courts to the extent that it reduces the pool of clients. Is it the intent of the bill then to preclude individuals from access to legal representation? As in Section 2, I know we discussed this briefly in Representative Hilstrom's committee, but this is new territory for us.
Mr. Chairman, we don't believe it does, and I guess obviously the court would have to decide that. What we're trying to get at here is that either people, or at least give some hard and fast rule, number, whatever you want to call it, so that judges are looking at that. Our expectation is that if there were folks that were, let's say, on that border, they wouldn't necessarily go pro se. If you look at Section 4 or Subdivision 4 of Section 2, which is the current law, the judges still continue to have some discretion as to whether or not somebody qualifies for public defender. And again, constitutionally, you probably have to have that, but also just on a practical standpoint, I think they would too. So it's, we don't believe that it does. Obviously, if it's going to have a fiscal impact on the court, I mean, we'd have to visit with them and you all would have to take that in consideration.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you asked the first question I had, which is related to Section 4.
And I think maybe I'll decline from requesting an amendment on that in deference to my friend Cliff Paylor, to the extent that Hennepin County is getting a 100% premium back on what they're paying from the state. If the county is paying one-third, the state's paying two-thirds of those public defender costs, but 100% of the reimbursement goes to solely Hennepin County, it would seem there is a problem there related to who's getting the money and who's actually paying for it. That said, I'll zip it after that. however, I did have, and I asked this question, I don't know if I asked this question of the last time in committee or personally Mr. Kyer, but it would seem Section 5 and 6 are problematic, because if we're looking for parity and we're looking to ensure that only people who are entitled to public defender representation are actually getting it, it would seem that Section 5 and 6 take us in the opposite direction. Instead of saying that if a guy who could afford a private attorney but's getting a free one provided for the state, if you find out that he's getting it free, the previous language is the court shall order the reimbursement. But we're changing it to, well, no, you may order the reimbursement. And your statement is that could affect the decision of judges to appoint in the first place, and we don't want them to not appoint. But it would seem to me that that's the entire point of a reform bill like this, which I would think this would be kind of a reform bill, and I don't think that the object of a reform bill either is to say, well, we don't know the direction it's going to have. I think the point should be it should reduce your caseload, only to the extent it should reduce your caseload by the amount of people that are getting free lawyers that shouldn't be. So it should have an impact on your caseload. And it would seem that Section 5 and 6 are taking us in the opposite direction of where we want to go in that. So with that, I think, Mr. Chair, I'd like to offer an amendment to delete the language in Section 5 and 6.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Hilton, you know, I'm trying to figure out here too if this is a major substantive amendment that was not did not fulfill the rules of the committee, and I need to represent Hilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Board of Public Defense said they don't have a problem with it.
They don't have. Mm-hmm. You want to go ahead with it?
I'd like to. Yeah.
Okay. Then Representative Lesch moves to delete Section 5. And
6.
And Section 6 of the bill. Right. Any discussion on the amendment?
No, Mr. Chair.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry, I had to step out during the beginning of the presentation, but I'm a little just confused about the effect of what we're voting on here. Maybe if Representative Lesch could just give us another little explanation of what the intent of your amendment is, what the effect of your amendment is.
Representative Lesch.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Representative Liebling, the current language says if it's determined that an individual is found to be ineligible, that the court shall order reimbursement of costs. The language changed. The amendment changes the words to may. The court may decide that they could or they couldn't, so really kind of a wash there. And then Section 6 deletes the schedule, I believe. Is that correct, Mr. Kyer? The schedule by which it's determined?
Mr. Kyer?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lesch, Section 6 is the guideline of the schedule. It's not necessarily a mandatory. I mean, and as I said, it's rarely used, if ever.
Okay.
So,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The reason we don't have an issue with Section 5 and Section 6 being deleted is, again, if Section 6 isn't used, you're just going to take it out of the statute because it isn't rarely used. But the second was on the reimbursement. It was the intent of the public defenders to hope that if they weren't required to reimburse, that on the front end, that the public defenders wouldn't get appointed, but that private attorneys might. And so it was an attempt to affect their caseload in that direction, but we're fine.
Then
We will vote on the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick comment on the amendment. My concern with the comment that you might, the public defenders might not get it appointed. Sometimes the judges also appoint public defenders on those cases because they don't want to gum up the system with having somebody floating around the system without an attorney. And you're doing just the opposite when you remove that shell and me, possibly. That's my concern with that provision that I... And I realize sometimes the public defender gets slightly misused on those cases because you probably shouldn't be there. But on the other hand, if you're not, believe me, I've seen how the system doesn't seem to get anywhere trying to deal with all the hearings that can be required when you're dealing with somebody that doesn't understand the law.
Mr. Liebling, was yours the question for this amendment?
I asked that question, but I had a separate question to another part of the bill.
Any other discussion on the amendment? All those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. Okay, now, Representative Coles.
My question was about Section 5. It's no longer necessary.
Okay. I should have said that the amendment prevails. The amendment fails. The amendment prevails. The polls yield nothing. All right, Representative Hillstrom, anything else you want to... Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a question that didn't pertain to that amendment. And again, I'm sorry I had to step out during the beginning of the presentation, but it seems to me that what we're doing here... I guess my question is, I'm looking at Section 2 and putting in these standards, which makes some sense, but it seems to me that you're giving absolutely no consideration in the added language to whether the person has any assets. You're talking about annual income. Mm-hmm. And then when you get down to 4 in Section 2, which is the current language, then you're talking about assets and income. And so I guess I'm a little troubled by this because I think there's a lot of inconsistency being injected here. I mean, especially in the current climate that we're in, somebody could be laid off, have no current income, and in fact own lots and lots of property. And I think then, so what you may be doing here is giving people access to public defenders that maybe don't even have access now, that maybe shouldn't have access, because if a person has a lot of assets, this is the situation in which they should use them, mm-hmm. It seems to me. So could you kind of discuss that? I mean, I've had some experience with this number 4 current law thing, and I think it's often interpreted wrongly. I've had judges send potential clients out to get me to say that they can't afford a public defender, and, you know, instead of... to find out maybe what the reasonable costs are. So I think it's often misinterpreted, but at least it does refer to liquid assets and current income.
Mr. Kaya.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Liebling, the way this is drafted, at least with Section 4, it would allow for a court to look at those liquid assets. Now, if that's not the case, obviously that's not the intent, but it does do that in Section 4, and I guess if that's not the intent, we'd be happy to sit down and visit with you to make sure that doesn't, because that's obviously not the intent, but that's where we're at with that. If we do have that same concern, and we've brought a few of those cases to the Court of Appeals where folks had some substantial assets that, you know, were then not used or considered. So, but the interpretation of the law, there's nothing, you know, that we could do about that one. I mean, that's... But, so...
Good point.
I'd just like to point out that it's true that that language does stay in, and Representative Eastland just pointed out under Mr. Kyer's answer to a question in Representative Hillstrom's committee that all of us on legislative salaries with 2 kids would qualify for a public defender. If you make under 46,000 2 kids. That's 200% of poverty guidelines under the language that was triggered.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Lex, we'd be happy to serve you.
Representative Liebling?
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess I'm still a little confused about this, but Maybe I'm the only one here who's still confused about how this is working, but I have to say I haven't really thought this through, so I'll let it go for now, and maybe I'll get an opportunity to talk to Mr. Kier or Representative Bilstrom about this later on.
Is there any other discussion on the bill? Then the chair will lay over House File 161 as amended for possible inclusion in either the, well, in a finance bill or figure out where it goes. But all those in favor, oh, we don't need to vote on that,
no.
Sorry. Okay, we're off that. Thank you, Ms. Kier, Representative Hillstrom. I want to remind committee members about the 24-hour rule. If you do have a substantive amendment, Representative Lash, it would be nice to get those in. I really would think it would make the committee process work more smoothly.
I promise I will from here on out.
Okay, there's no further discussion. This meeting is adjourned.